See you next time. This is Jerry Silva. Think outside the cage. Give, please give to KPFK. Thank you.
When we say this is listener-supported free speech radio, what are we really saying? The free speech radio part is about thought-provoking, challenging programming that uncovers stories you wouldn't normally hear on the radio. Listener-supported means it's your money that pays for those programs and the transmitters, the computers, the electricity, everything it takes to bring you this service. So here's a very large thank you to you, a listener in listener-supported free speech radio. And if you haven't yet gone from listener to supporter, please do so now. Give online at kpfk.org.
Welcome to Beneath the Surface. I'm Susie Wiseman. Today we welcome back Robert Brenner and Mark Cooper, two longtime left socialists, to get their views of the state of the election after a knockout convention that lifted spirits and Kamala Harris's chances to defeat Trump. The convention was historic in several ways. It was pro-union and featured the UAW's Sean Fain, and the speakers and delegates were diverse, younger, and more openly progressive on issues that matter. But what does it all mean? Judging by the polls, candidates Harris and Waltz successfully walked the delicate tightrope that is internal Democratic politics. Palestinian Americans were denied a chance to address the convention. And while Harris called for a ceasefire and nodded to the suffering in Gaza, she did not mention an arms embargo. The climate catastrophe was also acknowledged, but little more. It was still an historic convention in multiple ways that we'll touch on while looking at the race ahead. We'll also ask for your support for this program and for KPFK during this summer fund drive. All this when our program returns in just a moment. And welcome to the show. I'm Susie Wiseman. The Democratic Convention riveted attention this week in a masterfully choreographed, spectacular show that showcased stellar speeches and a unified party in the face of Trump's authoritarian threat, bolstered by recent Supreme Court decisions. The stakes are high, and the Democrats delivered. Each night of the convention focused on the different constituencies that make up and divide the Democratic tent. The first night saw speeches from the left of the party and the labor movement. It was pro-union and featured the UAW's Sean Fain. The speakers and delegates were diverse, younger, and more openly progressive on issues that matter to the base of the party. It also featured gender progress, with Hillary Clinton arguing that Kamala Harris has shattered the ceiling she tried to crack at a moment when women's hard-fought rights have been reversed and are under attack by Trump, the MAGA constituency, and the courts. The second night featured the Obamas, who took aim at Trump and Project 2025, as opposed to the more expansive and inclusive Harris-Walz vision that moves the country forward, not back, and fights for democracy and the right or freedom to choose. The third night was a nod to the Clinton-Obama neoliberal wing of the party, but emphasized unity in the fight to protect the freedoms under attack, from voting rights to gender and reproductive rights. Vice presidential candidate Waltz's speech was dedicated to solidarity, neighborliness, and the promise of a progressive, redistributive policy or policies that he won as governor of Minnesota and which could go national. The final night was all about national security, defined as the threat to individual liberty and democracy that Trump represents, featuring Republican speakers appealing to others like them to see that their values are championed more by the Harris-Waltz ticket than the Trump-Vance one. It was like an essay that tied together all the threads to mobilize the broadest numbers to reclaim patriotism as the fight against everything a Trump presidency and Project 2025 would mean. So, was it a success? What does it mean for the campaign ahead? We get a spirited discussion from Robert Brenner and Mark Cooper, two veteran leftist socialists who discuss the significance of this election. And so before we do that, I just want to introduce or reintroduce my guest. Mark Cooper is a veteran journalist, a former staff writer at The Nation, and a retired USC journalism professor. He's the author of several books, and he now writes a must-read newsletter called The Coop Scoop, and that's thecoopscoop.substack.com. And Robert Brenner is an editor of Against the Current and New Left Review, professor emeritus of history and director of the Center for Social Theory and Comparative History at UCLA, and the author of several books, including The Economics of Global Turbulence and Boom and Bubble and others. And pertinent to the subject, as always, is this ongoing conversation that Brenner and Dylan Riley began when they wrote Seven Theses on American Politics in New Left Review, which is an analysis of American politics post-midterms, that's 2022, that has generated a stirring debate across the pages of lots of journals and reintroduced many political concepts. And disclosure, Robert Brenner is also the executive producer of this program. So, okay, with all of that, welcome to the show, both of you. So let's, before we get into the entire convention, Robert Brenner, I think you wanted to talk a little bit about your views on where we are in terms of both parties having finished their conventions and what it means for the state of politics right now in the country.
Yeah. I mean, I think essentially what you had was a, objectively speaking, a reconfirmation of the very, very closely divided state of politics in this country, in which very small missteps open the way to huge advantages for the opposite side. So effectively, you end up with a situation in which, from the Democrats' standpoint, I think it's best to hit where we end up, and then we can go back and say how. They end up with what is really a quite perfect kind of encapsulation or slogan for going forward. And that is, ironically, we ain't going back. And the beauty of that for the Democrats is that going into the convention, or for the whole previous Biden administration, you had one after another major important bits of legislation that effectively expanded the Democratic Party project. But they were, in my opinion, quite at their limit. The Republicans, similarly, were in a parallel position, because their line was essentially that where the Democrats ended up with we ain't going back, the Republicans' position all through was let's take our country back. But that's a slogan that, while appeals to a huge part of the population and is, it seems to me, the driving force for Trump and the Republican Party, it has a weakness, which is that it can't be said, because its racism is just too open. And what they ended up doing was massively overreaching in this respect by allowing their project, a 2025, to come out where this take our country back line was implemented in a 1,000-page detailed document. So in a sense, both parties were in analogous position. The Democrats, because they had achieved probably the maximum that they could achieve without another election, without that, they were at a point at which they really could not get much more. So again, so that ain't going back was perfect for them, because they didn't want to start out by saying, here's what we want, and now we have to compromise by saying ain't going back. They implicitly compromise by saying we ain't going back. And that means they don't have to achieve all that much. The Republicans, I think, are in an analogous position in saying they're going to take their country back, but and that is a very powerful politics for them, but it's a politics that is less and less can be said. And I think it's we'll find out. But it's an interesting question. I think it looks like, it's hard to say, maybe it's just because the Democratic convention is just ending, but it looks like Trump's ability to use that approach has reached its limit. We're at a kind of an impasse where the Democrats start off with a Biden administration, which was very accomplished quite a lot, but a lot of it under the justification of the pandemic. They stop referring to the pandemic, and they're pretty much at a standstill. The Republicans are at a parallel place in terms of their own position, and what they need to do is essentially, like the Democrats, not overreach. But where the Democrats started out in trouble because of Biden, I don't think it's very substantive, but because of Biden, and corrected with this ain't going back, the Republicans started out in a much stronger position, but kind of ruined their advantage by their choice of Vance. So I think in a way, that's where I would leave it as as an intro to our discussion.
Okay, so, but I want to take it now, like Mark Cooper, I want to have you come in, but go back to, you know, a little bit before that, we've gotten an overall sort of picture from Bob about the stasis, the dead heat, in a sense, because of, you know, where we were. But now, following the convention, which, you know, just ended, we have, you know, the Harris-Waltz campaign quite a bit ahead. And so I just, before I ask you to get your overall view of the convention and where we go from here, because we want to hit on a lot of other points, just to say from my point of view, the Democratic convention was kind of like masterfully choreographed, was an up. And I think it showed that the significance of the kind of speeches that we got from the Clinton-Obama wing of the party and the neoliberals and the blue dogs was that the party seems to realize that the fight against the right and the threat to democracy and the system itself is more important than the fight against their own left base. I used to say the Republicans fear their base and the Democrats hate theirs. But after we've had Bernie and after we've had so many different things go on, now they're trying to seemingly show that the left and the party is also important for their ability to win. And I think it's an important point. The question is whether it's a change in tone or is it so much more? So, Mark, I'm sorry to introduce that aspect of it, but what's your view on what came out of that?
First of all, I do not believe that as of this morning that we are in a symmetrical static situation, with a caveat. Reading poll numbers that are 4, 5, 6 points apart on any given day can mean something, but they might not. What counts are the trend lines. And people talk about, well, she's ahead by 3 points, she's ahead by 4 points. All of that is irrelevant. What's relevant are the trend lines. So, for example, if you look at Nevada, Arizona, and Georgia, which are the three Sun Belt swing states, Harris has been behind there, and she's starting to catch up. She might have already moved ahead in Arizona and Nevada. She's still behind in Georgia. He's going down, she's going up. So it's a matter of a week or two. I think it's noteworthy that in Kamala Harris's speech, she didn't refer to the word Democrat one time, and that's conscious. I've also been reading the critiques of the convention from both the right and the left. The right, I think, Bob, to say that the right is overstepped is like saying Hitler has a mustache. They are in outer space and have no idea how to bring this back into orbit. They might not have to, but their strategy excludes even trying to win the middle. Their strategy is trawling the bottom of the ocean and trying to pick up another 5 or 6 million of the 80 million Americans who never vote, who they think could be supporters of theirs. I think that the critique that the convention was not political enough, that there wasn't enough policy, that it was all about freedom and joy and patriotism. It was. Those are not my politics, but I'm not running for president of the United States. Okay. I'm a socialist. All right. Okay. So I have my politics. Those are not my politics. But do I think that was a good idea? Yes. I think it was a great idea because we are 70 days away from either maintaining what we have now with all of its flaws or going down the black hole of authoritarianism with Donald Trump. I also want to say that in the coverage and in the debate and discussion in our communities, I think while the question of Israel and Gaza is very important to many of us, that is not going to be the issue that she's going to be attacked on by the Republicans, because the Republicans have an even more belligerent attitude when it comes to this. They're going to attack her on immigration and the border. Okay,
right.
This September, October, November is going to be all about how she and Joe Biden let in millions of people to take your jobs, cut your daughter's throats, shoot fentanyl into your veins. That is going to be the major attack point. I read this morning that the Fed is going to lower interest rates. They're going to have trouble, the Republicans, on the economy. Mm-hmm. And the three of us sitting here have a different view of the economy than Democrats do for the most part. But in terms of traditional historic trends, the economy right now is doing quite well coming out of the pandemic, right? Could it be much more equal? Of course it could. The last thing I want to say on these related topics is that I think that, and this is what I find very interesting, and Bob sort of touched on it, which is if you think about it, right, the positions, the policy positions of Kamala Harris and Joe Biden are basically the same. Okay. There's some rhetorical flourishes that she's introduced about Israel, and I don't think those should be written off. Policy change always begins with empty words, and then those empty words have to be used to mobilize and organize and call people on their words rather than just call them war criminals. At some point, you have to come up with a plan to negotiate an international situation. But the point I wanted to make is this. If there is no real difference between Biden and Harris in terms of policy, why the excitement? And the answer is because of the vibes, because of the feeling, because that's what Donald Trump runs on. Donald Trump doesn't have any policies. He just has bluster and emotional, visceral denunciations. That's what our politics have come down to. And people are tired of that. And in January, we can debate Medicare for all or not, depending on the composition of the Senate and the House. But at this moment, we have one priority only, and that is 70 days from now, we have to make sure we don't elect a mentally impaired, world-class, imbecile authoritarian with his leaders to screw up this country. I was going to say to build a dictatorship, but they're not even capable of that, right? They would build chaos. And that's where we're at this morning.
I think that's really a good place to put it, because one of the things that made this convention so successful is that everybody's unified on that point. And they gave, you know, more than lip service. Bernie spoke, AOC spoke, Sean Fain spoke of the UAW. There was a lot of tipping toward the various constituencies, but everybody was on the same line that about democracy and this is about preventing Trump and that this is the key issue that overrides everything else. And I think on that, and having Walz, who was, you know, like I think a genius pick for the ticket, that made this convention successful.
And I do think that while most Democrats, I don't know, we don't know. We have polls It depends who's doing the polling. Well, I think most Democrats are at least, shall we say, uncomfortable at a minimum with what's happening in Gaza, right?
Yeah.
There's also a greater number of voters who feel an affinity with Israel. This is a very delicate situation. I do not think, however, it is going to have much impact on Harris's vote, because watching the convention, the TV cameras shied away mostly from the protests on the floor, but those were very small. That was conducted by 10 or 15 people who we know. Okay.
And that was insignificant. I think the far greater one, was the uncommitted people outside who were very serious.
Correct. Except they wanted to bring 35,000 people and they brought 3,500. Okay, in the street. I'm not criticizing them. All I'm saying is that the people who were the uncommitted and the adjacent area around it, I believe those people upset with the Democrats who hate the Democrats over Gaza, I think a lot of them understand that they're still going to vote for Harris. And that's why the street demonstrations failed.
What do you think on that, Bob?
I don't even think it's an issue. I think there's a lot of talk, mm-hmm. a lot of fireworks without fire that, you know, is going on this question.
Yeah,
I think no votes, virtually no votes, will be lost to Harris because of her crappy position on Israel.
Yep.
I would say just look at the Palestinian constituency. You know, the Palestinians have been screwed over again and again, but the Democrats are not going to pay a tiny price for this, because they have in reserve Donald Trump. And what that means is that, you know, anyone who's in the game realizes what is the first rate issue and what's a second rate issue. And in this case, sorry to say, but it should be probably said, this Palestinian issue is a 10th rate issue given the American political scene. You know, for me, it's a gigantic issue. It's a catastrophic moral overstep, you know, that the Democrats have been, you know, participating in forever. But I don't think anything is going to change on that score. I don't think we need to belabor it, because I think a huge number of people agree that the issue of Palestine is of huge significance. But I think they also agree that it's not going to get much of a hearing in this electoral go-round, because there's nothing in it for the Democrats. They get nothing for being decent on this question. And you will not see the Democratic Party do anything decent of this sort unless they're forced. And that means millions of people in the street and so on. We know what that looks like. That's the late 60s. That's the Vietnam movement. That paid dividends. And as soon as you had those millions in the streets for several years, it did pay off. But it also took years to do it, and it required an issue in which a huge part of the population was affected. The Palestinian issue is not like that at all, unfortunately, or fortunately. No. It's unfortunately, because it means that the Democratic Party can pursue mindlessly a truly immoral trajectory. You know, to conclude what I'm trying to say, which is that while the Democrats have, it seems to me, carried out a brutally immoral position with regard to the Palestinians, and carried it out actually brutally. They know exactly what they're doing. And the idea of having so little in terms of Palestinian voices is a perfect expression of this. But on the other hand, the pro-Palestinian forces know perfectly well what a catastrophe this issue is for anyone who wants to move the country further in a decent direction. So at this moment, they have to effectively back off. Let me just conclude by saying, look on the other side. Look at the Trump forces. They're not going to be able to do anything with this issue. This is not an issue they're even going to be able to broach. So what becomes the issue? Zora, I'm sorry to go round and round a little bit on this. But what has happened is actually, I think, and this should be registered, is that compared to where we were actually in 2020, 2021, the forces of motion, if you will, have had to move backward. This is indicated by the Democrats in a implicit and not very wide open way saying, yeah, we have the slogan now, we ain't going back. Because the politics that we had, we've reached the limit that we're able to push them and without a big attack, without a redistributionist politics, that would take another a victory. At this moment, they don't have it. You know, Susie made the point, you know, from one point of view, it was a very, quote, successful convention. On the other hand, it was a pretty vacuous convention. I'm sorry to say, it was the perfect Democratic Party, multicultural feast in which, was there any mention of class? Was there any?
There was.
There was a lot. Including Kamala Harris.
Maybe
speech.
We should have this. We should shift to something that has a sharper edge. I believe the convention had zero substance in terms of class. It had lots and lots of rhetoric. The convention could not have been more successful in terms of the Obamas and the Clintons and so on. But on the other hand, there was no attempt to push what had been a very, very, the most progressive political thrust, you know, administration period since Roosevelt, mostly thanks to Bernie and the forces that he mobilized. But that was at a limit. And so what the situation is perfect for was to look good, to look radical, and it had what did not happen before. I think convention put the Obamas, Clinton back in the driver's seat, and you know, there was a degree to which Bernie and AOC and so on were clearly part of the game, but their message was blunted.
Well, okay, so let's
I'm going to respond to that.
Yeah, go ahead.
I've gone to every Democratic convention for the last 40 years. I have never seen a Democratic convention where labor was more present. I'm not saying that it was fantastic. I'm not saying there were pictures of the working class. I'm not saying there were a lot of working class speakers. But I'm saying that there has never been in my 40 years of experience a convention where labor had such a prominent role.
And that's what makes it historic.
Nor were the speakers made a point of at least saying the right things about them. The other thing I would say to you, Bob, is that your analysis of the Democratic Party is absolutely correct, but it forgets one thing. No political party is static. We've just seen the Republican Party completely transform itself into an insurrectionary cult around one person with absolutely no program. Right. And that means that discussion of policy and program has been taken off the table to a great degree by Donald Trump. I would say that there was a half-assed attempt, not a full one. There was a half-assed attempt by the Democrats to push younger people forward. And I think that we do not know. Nobody here on this podcast or listening at this moment knows what the public consciousness is going to be if the Democrats win in November. that will raise expectations among the population, and we don't, and that will provide an opportunity for progressives who are all pissed off now because AOC didn't, you know, denounce whatever they wanted her to denounce. All those progressives will now have a chance to organize and to push for the redistributionist policies that you want. Let me just say this final thing. This is the last thing I really want to say about the election. Much of this debate is just pointless and moot, because I'll point to the French example. When the French 2 months ago were confronted with a fascist threat, you know very well what happened. Not only did the center and the left agree to oppose the fascists, they also agreed to do something that would be unthinkable here. Of course, we have a different system that's not parliamentary. But they voluntarily decided to withdraw a number of their own candidates so the vote would not be split. That is because French leftists and French centrists and even French conservatives to a degree understood that that month, the only thing they had to do was to stop Le Pen. That is where we're at today. To me, I just want to get this out of my system. I turn on Twitter and I see the Twitter left excoriating Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. I'm not sure why, but they say that she's a sellout. She's now part of the party. She's this. So what do I think about that? As somebody who's been a socialist all my life and who's never been a Democrat, and who's probably a little bit to the left of AOC on some things, I say, well, God, it's pretty interesting. We had a handful of social Democrats elected to Congress. That's good, but we don't have a parliamentary system. To me, the degree to which those five or six or seven or nine socialists or democratic socialists can integrate themselves into the party and exercise some influence inside that party, I find that to be a positive. I don't think there's anything particularly redeeming about staying on the margins. If you want to be on the margin of the Democratic Party, that's fine. Don't be in it.
I just want to say that this takes us to a place in the broadcast where we move from the convention to the campaign. And just the last thing to say there is that it's a testament to, I would say, the accomplishment of the Democratic Party to reconstruct, at least at the convention, the tent that allows these different forces to be within it. And it does raise the point about, you know, I think that Matt Karp addressed was whether or not the Democrats have finally co-opted the left or the left has co-opted the Democrats. That's a moot point because everybody seems to realize that defeating Trump is the key task. So what does it mean now? Because Mark, you alluded to the fact that there's eight swing states, that right now Harris is ahead. She may or may not have a problem winning Michigan after what happened at the convention.
She's going to win Michigan.
Yeah, so it looks like but now it looks like, you know, there's a lot of really important things to do in the next 75 days. And that is to continue the vibe and to the contrast between cruelty and mocking people and positive way forward. We're not going back. And then the other hand is they really have to work hard on winning the Senate, because it looks to me like they're going to win the House, but the Senate is really key.
The Senate, we don't know. The Senate, the best case scenario for the Senate is 51 Democratic senators, and that's very difficult. It's more likely they'll wind up with 49 or 50, okay, or less, or maybe 52. We don't know. I want to say something about the House. The House is probably going to become Democratic. The margin is very important, because we're talking about if we get 50 Democratic senators and a Democratic president, then we're back to the issue of the filibuster, which means that the margins in the House are also important, because there are conservative Democrats. And that's the point I wanted to make.
And that was going to be my next question.
My congresswoman is one of eight blue dogs. Okay, she's campaigning on two issues: choice, which is good, she's pro-choice, and something we've never heard of because she's a small business mechanic. She's got some law, which is a good law, that will force big business to allow you to repair your own gadgets without violating the warranty. Because right now, if you can fix something, you're okay. Well, that's a working class issue. She is a working class candidate. Her appeal is to the working class. I live in a working class city. Okay. That's how she won, by being a mechanic. And I am going to vote for her. I'm going to vote for her in November. I'm going to close my eyes and vote for her because we need more Democrats in the House. I'm not a Democrat. I'm not a blue dog Democrat, but I don't want the Republicans controlling the House. It's that simple.
Bob, I want you to come in on that because we're really now changing the focus slightly from, you know, I think you were right to point out, and both of you have pointed out, that the campaign is now going to be more on, you know, hope and change and joy rather than the sour and also, you know, the chance of an authoritarian coming to power with and the chaos that that will bring. Mark raised the issue of the filibuster. I think that that's going to be the critical issue. And David Dayan wrote a piece and said, well, okay, Manchin and Sinema will now be out of the Senate. But were they the scapegoats for other more silent blue dog Democrats who feel the same way and might come way forward now? Because you would think that this would be the key task right now in the Senate in the next 70 days to change the rules. Because if filibuster stands and it's a divided Senate, even 50-50, it's going to be really impossible to get any of this implemented.
Wow. You just raised an issue I hadn't even thought of. That's right. They could actually do it now, couldn't they?
They sure could. And they should.
They're not going to, but
it's a rule change. It's not something that's
right. No, you only need 51 votes.
Yeah.
The Senate.
So, could they do it? And why shouldn't they? That would be, it would add to the campaign, I would think.
Yeah, but Manchin is still the sitting senator.
So, yeah. Bob, you know, given everything that we've just said about the convention and the campaign ahead and the tightness of the race and the possibility of ending the filibuster, what are your thoughts?
My thoughts are that effectively, unless something changes, essentially the mainstream of the Democratic Party, I don't know if it is the mainstream, but the political weight of the Democratic Party, to the extent it's in the Obamas and Clintons and so on, has been restored. And that you had a break from this politics to the left. The politics that occurred in 2016, 2020, and 2022 is a very delicate situation because the country is so completely divided. I'm hoping that the Trump thrust, which really began with Bannon in, you know, 2012, 2013, 2014, has run its course. And that from what I've been able to see, it's subtle, but I believe that Trump is far weakened as a result of these two conventions and the stuff that's happened in between. Finally, all the charges that have been built up against him have begun to tell. You know, he's swung out at various points in a way that has been very counterproductive for him. So on the one hand, I think that, you know, implicitly, the Democratic Party has a good chance of essentially consolidating an anti-Trump politics. But I think just saying that elides a centrally important point, which is that what that really means, if you look at the way the convention was covered and the look of it, despite, you know, all, I agree with you, both of you, that you had quite a few younger, blacker, browner voices, names that leap out at me, or, you know, the guy from
Westmore from Maryland.
Exactly. Westmore is a name that leaps out to me from Maryland and so on. You know, I think the Democrats, they're right to boast about these younger battalions in the sense they have more talent and are it's a much more interesting look than, you know, Steny Hoyer, for example, who was
an ageist remark, but yes.
Well, I didn't think of him in terms of his age. I thought of him as the perfect right of center Democrat or center. So, but I think that to say it was lost is hard to, you know, show, because it's hard to know that if it ever was really confirmed. And that was under Biden, you know, a very major program to expand the welfare state in many respects. It was a moment, very brief, had a very, very particular roots, but it represented a very major move to the left in the Democratic Party. And in their program. So until I'm shown differently, I'm not at all clear that Kamala Harris or anyone else will.
But Bob, of course not. Did you think when Joe Biden was running, did you think in the summer and fall of 2020 that Joe Biden was going to be the president that you now describe as one of the great presidents? You had no idea because we were supporting Sanders. We didn't have any faith. It was the Sanders movement for sure that pushed Biden to where he was. You're right about that. The only thing where I disagree with you is that I don't see any evidence whatsoever that the Democrats want to restore Bill Clinton. On the contrary, what I heard from people who were there and from a part of the organizers, they couldn't wait to get rid of him, and they hope this is the last time they ever see him.
I think it may be true with regard to Clinton. It's not true with regard to the Obamas.
Well, that's right.
Whose politics differ not one iota from the Clintons.
That's correct.
So what I'm trying to say is that the situation is very, very critical in the sense of any further forward motion, because there was this forward motion. I think that the aesthetic beauty of this convention, which everyone loves, has basically covered the vacuity of this
convention. Of course it has. That's the whole point of it. That was the entire point, Bob. Let me ask you a very simple question, okay? I'm not gonna patronize you by saying, do you want Harris to be elected? Because we know you do. The question is, nobody in this discussion is a Democrat. We're all socialists. We're not in the Democratic Party, okay? My question to you is, as somebody who's not a Democrat, but who wants a Democrat to be elected, would you have designed a different convention that was more political, more policy, more redistributionist, and less catering to the Republican center? Is that what you would have done?
Let me add to the point, too, because I think that the question is really, you know, and the surprise that I had, because as soon as I saw that the Obamas and Clinton and all the others were going to speak, I worried that signaled some kind of, you know, allegiance to it. But I saw instead that this was used to portray a kind of unity of the party so that they can move ahead to defeat Trump. And in their speeches, there was no sort of hearkening back to the policies that they put forward. There was certainly, you know, a tribute to women breaking through and that this election is historic. And to Walz's left populist, I think they would say, kind of politics that they seem to approve of. So I think in a way, I'd like to get, you know, sort of, we're running out of time, but get your sense of that and what it means for the way forward. Because I thought that they accomplished a lot by being able to pull that off in a very divided party.
I don't think the party is divided at all. I think that basically you have the Blue Dogs have lost. On the other hand, who has won is basically, as far as I can tell, and I hope I'm wrong, but I think from the standpoint of the New York Times and the people who are a little bit to the left of the New York Times and watch this convention, they love it. You know, they love the Obamas being the face of the Democratic Party. Oops. And unfortunately, I don't see there's likely to be any other face. I mean, you have someone like Mark mentioned, like Wes Moore, but I'm very dubious that you'll see with Harris much change. And I think that it requires a new source of momentum, a new kick. And that previous one was electoral, but very very unusually successful electoral push led by Sanders with people like AOC and the others. I'm trying to take a historical look at this. And what I believe has happened is that that push has reached its limit, and that it's a real question of what is going to, you know, what is going to happen now. I think if you watch, I'll be very happy if you see a radical electoral campaign.
Okay, we have to end that because we let Mark respond.
I want to thank Bob for his extreme pessimism, because I'm usually the most pessimistic. So it feels good to be slightly less, I don't want to say optimistic, slightly less pessimistic. Of course, Bob, that is a great possibility. But you know what? The forward movement stopped 3 years ago. It stopped 3 years ago because of the pandemic, and because refusal of Biden to move forward, and because the Trump, who we thought was going to go away, survived and became a threat again. And that changed the entire playing field. And all I want to say is this: your pessimism is historically founded and respected. Having said that, I don't think you are allowing for certain things that are going to happen. For example, do you think that if Kamala Harris, whatever her politics are, it doesn't matter. Do you think if the Democrats are elected in November, all the Democrats are now going to go to sleep like they did when Obama was elected? I don't think so. I think they're going to hear the starting bell. After 8 years of stasis, we can finally go out and do some real organizing. You know, the change is not going to come from Kamala Harris. And it's sterile to debate, is she going to do this or going to do that? The Democrats are going to do whatever the base Democrats and mass movements are going to force them to do. And you know that, and you said it. So we don't know yet. We don't know what situation we're going to be in November or January, and what the public consciousness is going to be. The campaign is going to be completely apolitical because she wants to become president, and because she wants to win the center, and she wants to win dissident Republicans. And I support that. Those are not my politics. I just want the Democrats to be in power so I have some room margin to live, to organize, to think, and to breathe.
I'll let you respond to that quickly, Bob, and then we're going to
Okay, I'll just say, Mark, you're the pessimistic one. Because what,
go ahead. Thank you.
Because what you're doing, and I find it alarming, I don't find it necessarily wrong, is that I think what needs to be registered, it wasn't that the pandemic limited the way forward. The pandemic helped open the way. Under Biden, I just think this should not be lost, because it's so hard for any element that I'm familiar with on the left, from my far left friends to my center left academic friends, none of them like Biden. Biden is very disliked. There's no credit that wants to go to Biden. And what I want to emphasize is that what has happened, I don't know how much credit Biden gets for it, but Biden's administration became the focus for the most radical administration, period, since Johnson. I want to emphasize, because the people who were up there, especially the Obamas, they are forces for stopping that, for going no further. And I think that Biden was not exactly in no way himself a force that wanted to have to break from that, but became willy-nilly in the context of 2019, 2020, and the pandemic especially, which kind of opened the way for him, a sort of unintended agent of reform. And I think that he capped that reform when he said, no longer is the pandemic going to be a justification for going further? And we've had nothing since then. And so the question is there going to be a new, as Mark hopes, and I hope too, but I don't really see where exactly it's going to come from. I don't see any forces that are, leading to further change at this moment.
But so let me just come in and say that, you know, essentially what I think you're saying is that what we saw under Biden administration was an attempt, and maybe somewhat successfully, to reforge the New Deal coalition and take the party back from the elites that the Democrats had become, because they lost so much of the working class in pushing forward that, and they want to win them back, and Trump has them. So I think, you know, and I'm the optimist, and I'm always the optimist, I think that having Waltz part of the ticket, and having, you know, basically Kamala Harris's record, which has been mostly progressive, that there is a chance that they'll continue the politics of that, because it's popular and it might win back some of the working class. And we just have to see. That's the way I see it. So I'll give each of you like a 20-second response to that, and then we have to end the show. Mark?
My 20-second response is that we don't know, and that the forward movement that Bob talks about, the forces they talk about, I think you underestimate vastly the degree to which those forces were demoralized and demobilized by the inability to take down the filibuster, by the fact that we had a Democratic majority and the Democrats did not use it to move the legislation forward. And I blame Manchin and Sinema much more than Biden, by the way, because he did not have the votes.
Yeah, no, I agree with that.
He did not have the votes. You don't have the votes, you can't do it. It's that simple. So I think that I am optimistic that Harris is going to win. I am optimistic that expectations are going to rise. I am optimistic that leftists, progressives, and liberals who have felt defeated for the last 3 years are going to come back to life. They may give her a little bit of a honeymoon. They may swoon over her. I don't know. But there's going to be an uptick in organizing. There's going to be more labor unions, which are now more popular than they were before. And there's going to be a sigh of relief among many activists, including not at the working class level, but at the policy level and at the local political level. That threat of MAGA coming with guns for you is going to be lifted. And that's going to change the consciousness of the country.
Bob, you get a 20 seconds now.
I hope that you're right about that.
Or not.
I have trouble even articulating exactly what I think would be the conditions for moving forward. And so I think, I wish I were as sure as Mark.
I'm not sure.
I wish I were sure as Susie.
I'll take it.
I think you'll need a new Sanders-like push, and hopefully it would be much broader than that, much more in the streets and so on. I mean, you did have Black Lives Matter a bit.
We're going to have to leave it there. I think we get the point, and I want to thank both of you. This was a very spirited discussion. It'll be a lot of fun to listen to, I hope. But Mark Cooper, thanks for joining us, veteran journalist. And you can look at what he writes at thecoopscoop.substack.com. And Robert Brenner, editor of Against Current and New Left Review, author of many, many books and talking, and especially articles on American politics, 7 Theses on American Politics. Thanks so much for joining us today on the show. I'm back here, and I'm joined by Alan Minsky. He is no stranger to our airwaves. He spent many years as our program director, and he is now the executive director of Progressive Democrats for America. And I think you can guess it, but we're here to ask you for your support. And it's a really important message that we bring you. KPFK, and part of the Pacifica Foundation, is not funded by, as you know, corporations or anything else. We are entirely a listener-sponsored radio station, not a listener-supported radio station. We don't ask for your support along with a bunch of underwriting, but we just ask for your sponsorship. And this is the time that we need you to do it. So we're going to ask you to call in at 818-985-5735 and support this radio station and specifically this program, Beneath the Surface. And I'm going to let Alan talk to you for just a second. But I want to say that, you know, I've been on the air for a very long time. And of late, I've been sort of specializing almost by default on topics that I feel we can go into some depth on. One of them, of course, is in my own area of, let's call it expertise, and that's the former Soviet Union and Russia. Putin is as more repressive than we could have imagined, and so I've been covering a lot of that, and also labor, which I continue to cover. And these are kinds of topics that, you know, are not necessarily covered even on our own radio station in any kind of depth. So I have nothing but fun bringing them to you. And we'd like to hear your support for it. Alan?
I really want people to think about Susie's show and the kind of understanding that she provides for, obviously, she just talked about some European politics. She has exceptional coverage, of course, of Latin America and really of the whole globe. And what she provides is a capacity to look beneath the surface, right? Famous name of the show, and to see the sort of broader historical trends that are playing out in the specific manner in which they're playing out in all of these countries, and sheds light on what our reality is living in the 21st century with much greater depth than you get in almost any analysis on any show I know of anywhere else in American media. And I mean that. You're quite privileged in a way to be able to hear Beneath the Surface over the airwaves of Southern California. You can look at the immediate issues of contemporary politics in the framework of the broad arc of history with a deep understanding of the forces that are really driving that history. And that sheds incredible light on the present. And you get a deeper understanding of what's going on in the current politics much more than you do with the conventional surface analysis, which, again, it just seems sort of like these chaotic situations where, I mean, how is it that the United States of America has Joe Biden and Donald Trump as the two nominees of the two political parties in the dominant country in the world? What does that say about the state of America? And what are the forces that have driven our political system to be so sclerotic at this moment? And I bet you, you're not going to find any show out there that's going to offer up as much insight into that reality than Beneath the Surface with Susie Weisman. And that's just on domestic U.S. politics, which, by the way, you, as you talked about the things you focus on, you do focus on domestic U.S. politics as well and domestic U.S. economy. And notably, you do have a lot of the framing around the now growing and energetic union movement in the country, which again speaks to the way that our society reproduces itself, the general function of the society, and how that underlies the surface political crises that we see all around us. So Beneath the Surface is the show. KPFK is the station. You don't get anything like this anywhere else. 818-985-5735, 818-985-KPFK. This is better than a graduate degree education at just about any university in the world. I shouldn't say that because they're brilliant people who get graduate degrees around the world, but only they really match up in terms of the depth of understanding. And that's only in a few departments that aren't polluted by, you know, reactionary money these days. So 818-985-5735, 818-985-KPFK. Call,
and I'm gonna
support
just say,
the show.
And thank you so much, Alan Minsky. And I'm Susie Weisman. Remember, support the station and call in your pledge. 818-985-5735. Or kpfk.org. Thanks so much. And that's our show for today. I'd like to thank my guests, Mark Cooper and Robert Brenner. Thanks also to executive producer Robert Brenner, producer Melissa Figueroa, editor-engineer Juliana Gota, and Gary Baca in Master Control. You can listen to this and other archive shows as well as subscribe to the podcast at kpfk.org. Click Audio Archives and scroll down to Beneath the Surface with Susie Weisman. More information on programs and guests are on our Facebook page. That's Beneath the Surface with Susie Weisman. And you've been listening to Beneath the Surface on KPFK, Pacifica Radio for all of Southern California and beyond, streaming live and archived at kpfk.org. Thanks for listening, and please call 985-5735 to pledge your support and keep this program and radio station on the air. Stay tuned. I'm Susie Weisman.
818-985-5735, 818-985-KPFK. Press option 2 for the pledge line. You'll get the call center. Or go to the website, kpfk.org. Become a sustaining member of this station. It's not just that we need your support, but that you need us. We understand that this program has value to you. This program reflects values that you share. And if you appreciate those things, put your money where your heart is and donate a little bit to us. If everyone listening donated, we wouldn't have to appeal so often for funds. The statistics show that only 1 in 10 or 1 in 7 of the people who listen actually do donate in a fund drive, and we need to increase that. And